Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. This week, as the world converges, we ask, is it all happening too fast? We have Matthew Woods from the charity Converging World.
Julian Parry is here with his weekly portrait of contemporary life.
And Kojak's censored film, where he hunts down Eastern European Nazi collaborators in the Second World War. Look out for that one. We also have Jeff's What's On Guide. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2. Also on Preston, in Preston FM, and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you'd like to get involved, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen Square. We'll give you some more details about that at the end of the show. Many people will be surprised to know that the parish church of a small town in Wiltshire, Malmesbury, was formerly a very large Benedictine monastery founded around 676 by the scholar-poet Aldhelm, a nephew of King Ina of Wessex, apparently. The parish church is only a fraction of the original building, and much of it was destroyed in a big storm around 1500. Some surprising facts arise from the monastery's past history. It was the site of an early attempt at human flight when in 1010 the monk Aylmer of Malmesbury flew a primitive hand glider from a tower. He flew over 200 metres before landing but breaking both of his legs. Supposedly the first person to be killed by a tiger in England, Hannah Twynoy, is buried in the churchyard. She was an early 18th century barmaid working in a local public house, and she was killed on October the 23rd, 1703. So Dialect's reporter Anthea Page visited the Abbey to find out more about this fascinating history that it obviously has, from Abbey steward Janet Smith.
My name's Janet Smith. I'm one of the stewards here at Malmesbury Abbey.
Can you tell us a bit about the doorway? Very magnificent, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We think that a lot of this carving we owe to the fact that Malmesbury had connections with the Abbey at Cluny in France, and they had very skilled stonemasons here. The archway we're standing in front of actually consists of three separate sets of stories. The innermost arch tells the story of the creation of the world. The middle arch, you will find stories from the Old Testament. And the outermost arch will give you stories from the New Testament. It's getting a little bit weathered, but then it has been here 800 years.
As we go into the abbey, on our left, there's another amazing piece of sculpture. Could you talk to us about that, please? It says the Apostles.
Yes, indeed. We have, in fact, you have six apostles on each side with an angel flying above them. I don't know whether he's keeping an eye on them or looking after them or what. The other interesting thing in this part of the porch is that over the door you have a carving of Christ in majesty. And usually in medieval carvings, the bigger the carving, the more important the person that is being shown. However, in this case, Christ is quite small, and the apostles are not quite life-size, but they're a good 3 or 4 feet tall. We think that the reason it was carved like that is that they were saying that at the moment the important people are the church, the folks who are here, and although Christ will come back, the job is with the people on earth, not with him at the moment.
But there's some arches, that looks very Norman, the decoration.
Well, it is Norman. This building is about the third or fourth on this site. It was dedicated in 1180. It is Norman, as in the vast majority of the carvings and so on here.
But can you tell us a bit more about the history?
Well, that's a very long story, but an Irish monk called, or a hermit rather, called Maidulf. Malmesbury is a corruption of the words Maidulf's burg or town. He came here and settled in a hermit's cell, as a lot of Celtic Christians did at that time. And before very long, people heard of his wisdom and came to learn from him. Where you've got a small number of people, you need somebody to cook and clean and wash. And gradually the community grew until we had established a small monastery. And its first official abbot was Aldhelm, who was a relation of one of the kings of Wessex. And he started here in the year 676.
So how did the monastery decline? Was that under Henry VIII?
Henry VIII had a certain amount to do with it, but a lot of the damage to the church, and we have only about a third of the original church, was actually done by a storm about 40 years before Henry VIII. The original church was cross-shaped, and it had a very tall spire on the centre of the cross, reputedly taller than Salisbury Cathedral's, and we are on the top of a hill here. And in about 1500, the spire was struck by lightning. In any case, whatever happened, it brought it smashing down onto the east end of the building.
So how much remains now?
Well, we have about a third of the actual church and nothing at all of the outbuildings and the cloisters and so on, which would have been here when the monks were.
Do you have any monks still around?
No, there haven't been monks here since Henry VIII dissolved the place. When the abbey was sold off, it was sold to a local wealthy cloth merchant for just over £1,500, which doesn't sound a great deal to us, but in terms of money as it was then, would have been several million pounds. The church that the people used when this was a church for the monks, the parish church, was in a very poor state of repair. And although the abbey was sold on the understanding that it would be pulled down, the people of the town petitioned the king's commissioners that they be allowed to use the abbey church as their parish church, because it would be easier, simpler and cheaper than trying to rebuild the parish church they had from scratch, which is how it comes to be the parish church for Malmesbury now.
So it's very much a thriving abbey now, isn't it? Services, weddings.
Oh yes, it's used for all sorts of things. I mean, apart from... Well, we do everything that any other parish church does. We have regular Sunday services, midweek services, weddings, baptisms, funerals. But it's also used as a community hub, if you like. Last week, if you'd been here, you'd have found one of the groups running a workshop for the primary and secondary school here. We have concerts, we have all sorts of things. Our most famous venture is that we run a skate park here. They take out all the chairs, put hay bales in to protect the columns, build a skate park here for 3 days, and it brings the youngsters in and they get to hear, you know, about Christianity, and that's the sort of thing this abbey does, all kinds of things.
It's fantastic. Do you have a website?
We do. www.malmesburyabbey.com, I think.
That was Dialect's Anthea Page talking to the steward of Malmesbury Abbey, Janet Smith.
Well, how about this for a classic piece of Tony Gosling pleasure? A bit of conspiracy and, in a double bill spectacular, Kojak all wrapped into one story. Picture this, if you can. Telly Savalas playing his most popular role, Kojak, hunting down former Nazis in Belarus. Sounds unlikely, but it was the subject of a 90-minute Kojak spin-off feature film back in the 1980s. The film was based on a true story uncovered in the vaults of the US intelligence services by former FBI Nazi hunter John Loftus, and it was titled The Belarus File. It dramatised how inhabitants of the then Soviet state of Belarusia were recruited after World War II to work for the US intelligence services. It's all sounding a bit Len Dayton, this, isn't it? Only for it to be revealed afterwards that they were in fact the exact opposite, war criminals who had murdered thousands of their own countrymen during the war. They were Nazi collaborators on the US government payroll. So, why is the film important? Well, it has never been shown on British television, and it's almost impossible to obtain on this side of the Atlantic, so it must be important. So let's have a listen now to the never-before-heard voice of Telly Savalas facing some of the difficulties that John Loftus himself faced when digging up material that showed his own government in the White House in a very bad light indeed.
Let it go, Theo. It's a case. It's a case. You know what it's really about, Frank?
You've been throwing your weight around in the wrong places.
Like where?
The U.S. State Department.
Who'd they get to? The commissioner?
You know, it belongs in the task force. It's nothing personal.
Frank, listen, okay? Southern Russia. World War II. This is the part of Russia that's under German occupation, right? Some of the Russians, they collaborate. They help the Germans. They point out the Jews. Got it? Okay, the war's over. These bums, these Russian collaborators, they begin to show up at displaced persons camps, passing themselves off as real DPs. Now listen to this. Allied intelligence, they know all about these collaborators. They know all the crimes, they know the whole story. And now we got somebody in Washington comes up with a bright idea. Let's not punish these hyenas for what they did. Let's use them. We'll use them as guerrillas against the Soviet Union. But first, we got to train them. We got to sneak them into the United States. But that's against the law.
I can't believe this.
They set the whole thing up. The Belarus Brigade. These Russian collaborators training themselves to do something against Russia. And some of them were actually sent.
You mean a year, 2 years after the death camps?
Frank, I got a friend. He was in one of these death camps, right? 40 years go by. He's walking down a street. No, I'm just guessing. And he spots one of them. Hey! What's he doing in this country? What's he doing still alive? So he follows him. And what does he find? More collaborators. They killed his father. They killed his mother. They killed his sister. What does he do? And I'm just guessing. He went to the proper authorities. And he told them. And you know what? They stonewalled him. The way they stonewalled me.
Where's your friend right now, Theo?
Oh, I don't know. The question is, does my friend get to Bukhart before Bukhart gets to him?
Jeez. No wonder they want you off this. Who is this Bukhart?
Heinrich Bukhart. He was with the German occupation forces in Russia during the war. He's the one who started the Belarus Brigade. He's the one who started this whole group.
You're saying a commandant of a concentration camp.
I'm telling you about the real world, Frank.
And I'm telling you, I don't believe it.
And we think we know what it's all about, right? Some poor slob sticking a needle in his arm to find a little peace. Somebody holding up a candy store, sticking a knife into his neighbor. That's not what it's about, Frank. It's about power. The people who possess it, and the evil they do with it. That's what it's about, Frank.
Heinrich Bukhart, still on the U.S. payroll. The only contact with these other Russian collaborators. And with the help of the United States government, keeps the lid on this whole dirty mess. And you say it's just a case.
I'm telling you, it's too big.
For what?
For you. For us. I can't run interference anymore. We got away with it. We had a long run. You doing it your way. Me explaining to the bosses. But Theo, it's a different era. Now you're off the case.
Frank, because they don't know. And you got to tell them.
Tell them what? That Theo Kojak's on a tear?
I'm not on a tear, Frank. For 40 years, they've been keeping this from the American people.
You've just been telling me the facts of life. All right. It is about power. And Theo, you don't have any. You're not going to stop, are you? I can't help you.
Complete with a bit of lollipop slurping, possibly, if I heard that correctly, Tully Savalas there, and the unmistakable sound of TV detective Kojak, never before heard in Britain, and from the censored film The Belarus File. You heard it here first. Yeah. And another snippet that Loftus uncovered, which you may not have heard, is that Wallace Simpson and former King Edward were quietly arrested in 1939 by MI6. They were trying to flee from Spain to Nazi Germany. And I'm sure Ted Gosling will have some more of that in the coming weeks. Hooray! Now time for a weekly take on what's been going on in the world. Julian Parry.
Well, hello. You know, against a background of bankers making huge profits and riots in Egypt last week, I read an article in the Daily Mail which I thought was so good it deserved amplification. It was written by Fred Pierce and entitled, "The Last Thing Our Hungry World Needs is More Food." His basic thesis is that there's more than enough food in the world. The problem is poverty, and it all leads to trouble. The years 2007-2008 saw dramatic increases in world food prices, creating a global crisis and causing political and economic instability and social unrest in both poor and developed nations. In fact, we saw food riots in Bangladesh, Brazil, Burkina Faso, Cameroon, Côte d'Ivoire, or the Ivory Coast as we call it, Egypt, Ethiopia, Haiti, India, Indonesia, Latin America, Mexico, Mozambique, Pakistan, Myanmar, Burma as we all know it, Panama, Philippines, Senegal, Somalia, and Yemen. And there were a couple of other places where it came close to the mark as well. Now, the systemic causes for the worldwide increases in food prices continue to be the subject of much debate. There's a dramatic increase in prices, increased demand for more resources of intensified food, effects of petroleum price increases, declining world food stockpiles, financial speculation, my favourite, the commodity index funds, that's part of it. The effects of trade liberalisation have been blamed, the effects of using food for fuel, biofuel subsidies in the US and the EU have been blamed. Idle farmland, 38 million acres, I believe, in the United States alone. Agricultural subsidies, distorted global rice markets, crop shortfalls from natural disasters, soil and productivity losses, rising levels of ozone, and of course, always, climate change, responsible for everything. Now, the initial causes of the late 2006 price spikes included droughts in grain-producing nations and rising oil prices. These factors, coupled with falling stockpiles, all contributed to a rise in world food prices that in turn led to huge unrest and riots in the countries I've mentioned. Yet in one major newspaper this week, respected journalist Fred Pierce maintains, "Every time there's a famine, it turns out later that someone, usually just down the road, was hoarding food for sale. We already grow enough food to nourish 9 billion people, probably 15 billion people. In fact, we eat only about a third of the crops that are produced. The world's population will reach 7 billion this year and may peak at 9 billion by the mid-century. And there are plenty of things that are wrong with the world's food system, but the amount of food it produces isn't one of them." Now, this is where the government may be going wrong. Chief government scientist Sir John Beddington has called it the perfect storm, a unique moment in history, when launching his report from the government think tank Foresight. Soaring world population coupled with climate change, he says, is set to create a world food crisis, leaving billions starving. And his revolution that he wants to see is to dig up Africa. However, it's Fred Pierce's truth that the farmers' world could probably double the amount of food they grow using GM crops and other technologies, and still people would grow hungry. This is ultimately the problem. In poverty, that's where the problem lies. Beddington, as I said, wants to plough up vast tracts of Africa. And yet the real problem is that every time there's a problem with famine, it's that it can't be distributed fast enough and people can't afford it. But does Beddington's misdiagnosis really matter? Well, yes, it does matter, because Beddington's planned revolution stands a good chance of making the poor poorer, because he wants to bring in big companies and big government to do big things. And as we've all learned, that usually ends up in big mistakes. Another of the government's advisers, Professor Robert Watson, of the Department of Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, says something different. He says African smallholders should be backed, not stripped of their land. Local knowledge of crops would often work better than high-tech methods. And fighting poverty was the key to feeding the world. It's not a technical challenge, it's a rural development challenge, he says. The question is, how do we help them? One thing that would not be helping them is the financial speculation on Wall Street. It was in 2007 that Goldman Sachs decided to get in on the profit to be made from owning people's needs, not just their desires. Financial speculation in commodity futures following the collapse of the financial derivatives market has contributed to the crisis due to commodities-style, super-style, or super-cycle investment. Financial speculators seeking quick returns have removed trillions of dollars from equities and mortgage bonds, some of which has been invested into food and raw materials. That American commodities speculation could have a worldwide effect on food prices and is reflected in the globalization of food production. In a 2010 article in Harper's Magazine, Goldman Sachs was accused of profiting while many people went hungry or even starved. It was argued that Goldman's large purchases of long options on wheat futures created a demand shock. Well, it disrupted the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and that caused the price of wheat to rise. In The Economist, the argument was made that index tracking was also to blame. And in the end, the counter-argument is that if commodities without futures saw their prices rise as a consequence of rising prices with world futures markets, the World Development Movement states that there is a strong evidence that the rising price of wheat caused the price of rice to subsequently rise as well. There is the old thing about giffing goods that the economists well know. Well, now we have a new effect on the world food markets and money markets, and that's the US Federal Reserve pumping out dollars, this time in the name of quantitative easing. And once more we see food speculations as our own food costs rise, and once more Egypt is rioting. Quantitative easing and its terrible effects on food affordability has all been seen before. It happened in the late 18th century in circumstances which famously led Marie Antoinette to utter the much misunderstood line, "Let them eat cake." The maelstrom that followed is well known as a turning point in French history. But even then, it took one man to sort it all out. His name was Napoleon Bonaparte. Do we really want to see all that happen all over again?
Julian Parry, thank you very much for your eloquent research and excellent words. Thank you. Coming up soon, we have our guest Matthew Woods, but first, the popular singer Mr. Michael Jackson will regale us with Earth Song.
Children dead from war. stop to notice this crying earth as we make sure.
And that was Michael Jackson with her song.
It's now my great pleasure to introduce Matthew Wood from the charity Converging World. Hi, Matthew.
Hello.
Nice to meet you. So tell us a bit more about your charity.
Well, I'm from the Converging World, and we're a charity that believes that everyone in the world should have equal access to the world's resources in a sustainable way. And we don't believe that it's fair that the developing world should be prevented from developing due to climate change. So we invest into renewable energy, and we have projects over in India at the moment and projects in the UK to help people reduce their energy consumption and get more renewable energy in the ground here.
So your charity does quite a lot then?
Yeah, a fair amount.
How long have you guys been going?
It's been going for about 4 years. It started from a community group based near Bristol called Chewmagna. Well, the village is called Chewmagna, and it was really about how they can reduce their carbon emissions. And they wanted to come up with a way of doing that while also addressing this deep inequality in the world.
So it's got that kind of duality of having quite local, UK-centric kind of things going on in events and groups, and obviously the kind of wider projects, you know, in India, for example.
Yeah, twinning is very much about what we're about, and it's not just what we need to do here in reducing our carbon emissions, it's about what they need over in the developing world in terms of improving access to energy and greening their electricity grid. For example, India is heavily dependent on coal, much more than we are, which is obviously not good for carbon emissions, which is a global problem.
So take the community groups, kind of the local side first. What exactly do you do?
So what we did, there are lots of community groups out there who want to do something about climate change or fuel poverty in their areas, but they don't know exactly what to do. They might think, oh, let's put solar panels on all the roofs, or let's do a mass insulation scheme. But they don't know what's the most effective in terms of energy and carbon reduction, and what's the cheapest and what's the most practical. So we really help them to understand their area's energy consumption, what can be done in terms of reducing it, and what renewable energy they can put in. And then we handhold them through the process of taking forward projects. So if they want to put in a wind turbine, then we will help them overcome the barriers which will
planning and things like that, because these are quite large things, you know. Solar panels on roofs, wind turbines, it's not just as you say, just a bit of insulation in a few homes.
And our community groups are very ambitious. They don't just want to insulate one home, they want to do all of the homes.
That's fantastic.
They really want to get the whole area to be as carbon zero, carbon neutral as possible.
Great. On the other side of the coin, we've obviously got the projects in the other countries.
So part of our funding goes to our partner, SCAD, which is a local NGO in India called Social Change and Development, or SCAD. And they work with villages all across southeastern India and the state of Tamil Nadu. And what they do is they work with the rejected people from society, the lower caste, the rural poor. And they work with them with education programs, health programs, women's self-help groups, microfinancing, all that kind of stuff. And they've had a huge effect on the area. And that's really part of what we mean by sustainable development. They need to be able to grow out of poverty, but we can't prevent them from doing so using the excuse of climate change.
Sure. And so, I mean, India is the example, isn't it, really, of rocketing growth that needs to be fueled by something, whereas the Western world is suddenly saying, we've had our growth, but now you don't get yours. So, in terms of the issue of renewable energy in India, could you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, India's electricity is 90% based on coal, which is obviously not good from a climate change point of view. And also, in a few hundred years, our coal reserves will run out. They've really had to push renewable energy, also because there's a lot of people off-grid who need to be on-grid and need access to electricity. So Tamil Nadu is one of the windiest places in the world, and there are lots of wind farms going up there now which are helping to green their electricity.
You have a really interesting fundraising how you go about doing it and how you keep it sustainable.
Yeah, so we don't want to be a charity which just raises donations, spends them, and then has to go out and get more donations. So what we do is we raise donations, and those are invested directly into two large-scale wind turbines in India. And the sale of electricity and carbon credits from that is split three ways. Half of it goes to more turbines, so two turbines turns into eight in 10 years' time, so the fund continuously grows. Some of it goes to the local NGO to work with the groups out in India, and the rest of it comes back to us to help us fund our community work in the UK.
That's a pretty novel idea. I mean, do you know of any other groups that are doing this?
I don't know. I know there are mission-related investments which charities get into, but we've had a lot of interest about our model because it is so unique.
And getting to an issue a little bit closer to home now, in terms of kind of energy providers supplying green energy, is there a kind of element of some of that energy not being as green as we'd like to think it is?
A little bit. I mean, there's an obligation on energy companies to invest into renewables. And what some companies will do is they will offer their green tariff, but you'll just be paying for what they're obliged to do anyway. So you're just paying a premium for something they have to do, which is not really what it is green, but it's not really a very good deal for the consumer. But there are some green providers out there who do invest much more into green energy.
I mean, would you encourage people to choose greener energy kind of suppliers, but also to do more themselves, I presume, through the community groups?
Definitely. It's all about, you have to have a green supplier, an ethical supplier, but you also have to have your home fully insulated, and you need to not waste energy, be really good at managing your energy consumption.
In terms of how people can get involved in your charity, I presume they can kind of donate, but also can they get involved in other ways with their time?
Oh, definitely. We're looking very much this year to promote ourselves and get more donations and more people involved in our activities. So just on our website, there's various things people can do. It could be as simple as trying to get some more Facebook fans or following us on Twitter. But there's things, we've got various deals with companies which get us donations. But obviously, we would like more donations, which we can put into renewable energy.
Sure. I mean, you say you've been going about 4 years. How big is your charity at the moment?
There are 4 staff members and various advisors and volunteers. We're quite a small charity.
Okay. And if you could give someone a kind of the main tips, I suppose, for going green, I suppose that's very general. But I mean, have you got a bit of advice that someone could take away?
Insulate your home as well as possible. It's the most cost-effective thing you can do, and it will save you money. Invest your money into renewable energy, either as part of a scheme or as solar panels on your roof, or donate to the Converging World.
Absolutely. So if people want to find out more, could you let us know kind of how they can get in contact?
There's our website, which is theconvergingworld.org, or find us on Facebook. Those are the 2 main ways.
So just type in Converging World and it should come up.
Exactly.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Matthew.
Right, thank you.
And now here is Alec Milne to read the 5th part of the Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson, edited by Ernest Mayhew. The music is Duff, performed by Concerto Caledonia.
The Selected Letters of Robert Louis Stevenson. The Amateur Emigrant, America and Marriage, August 1879 to August 1880. On 30th July 1879, Stevenson's parents expected him to accompany them to Gilsland, a small spa in Cumberland. Instead, as his mother later recorded, he met them at the train and told them that he'd been called away on business. They later learned that he'd left for America. He travelled first to London, presumably to make the final arrangements for the journey and to tell his friends. They were bitterly opposed to what Goss called the maddest of enterprises and tried in vain to dissuade him. Colvin and Henley saw him off on the night train to Glasgow. Here he embarked on the Devonia, which sailed for New York on Thursday, 7th of August. The Devonia, an iron single-screw steamship of 4,200 tons, was one of the ships of the Anchor Line owned by the Henderson Brothers of Glasgow, which operated a regular service carrying mail and all types of passengers across the Atlantic. To save money and to collect material for a travel book, Stevenson planned to travel as an emigrant, but by paying 2 guineas more than the 6 guinea steerage fare, he was able to go as a second cabin passenger, thus securing better food and the use of a table on which to write The Story of a Lie. Stevenson's own account of his journey is given in The Amateur Emigrant, posthumously published in a shortened form in the Edinburgh edition. The full version, with the previously published text supplemented from the manuscript, was first published by James D. Hart in From Scotland to Silverado, 1966. Margaret Stevenson, usually so meticulous about preserving her son's letters, must have deliberately destroyed all those from this period of family dissension and distress, and the manuscripts of a number of the published letters to Colvin and Henley do not appear to have survived. In the full edition of the letters, it was possible to piece together much of what happened through Mrs. Stevenson's diary entries, letters to Colvin and Henley, and some surviving correspondence of RLS's parents. To W. E. Henley, New York, 18th August 1879. Dear lad, I have passed the salt sea with comparative impunity, having only lost a stone and got the itch. I could not eat and could not shush the whole way, but I worked. I am now dispatching a story as long as my arm to the vile Paul, all written in a slandicular cabin with the table playing Bob Cherry with the inkpot. The voyage was otherwise great fun, passengers singing and spewing lustily, and the stormy winds did blow. My news is bad, and I am wet to the skin. F has inflammation of the brain, and I am across the continent tonight. Addressed under cover to Joseph D. Strong, Monterey, Cal. I am ever your sincere and wet and scouted American, lodging in a shilling Irish boarding house with a flea in my lug and the itch, or at least an unparalleled skin irritation. Sometimes stings like a whiplash, and sleep is impossible to me. Last night I did not close an eye, but sat on the floor in my trousers and scratched myself from 10 p.m. to 7, when I arose, much better for the exercise. A little Irish girl, just bursting into figure, but dirty, is now reading my book aloud to her sister at my elbow. They chuckle, and I feel flattered. Yours, RLS. To Sidney Colvin, 24th September 1879, Carmel Valley. Here is another curious start in my life. I am living at an Angora goat ranch in the Coastline Mountains, 18 miles from Monterey. I was camping out but got so sick that two rancheros took me in and tended me. One is an old bear hunter, 72 years old and a captain from the Mexican War, a pilgrim and one who was out with a bear flag and under Fremont when California was taken by the states. They are both true frontiersmen and most kind and pleasant. Cap Smith, the bear hunter, is a physician, and I obey him like an oracle. The business of my life stands pretty nigh still. I am, I hope, cured of the itch which I got aboard ship. Yet I was in great part flayed. I still suffer as much distress as ever. I work at my notes of the voyage. It will not be very like a book of mine, but perhaps nonetheless successful for that. I will not deny that I feel lonely today. But I do not fear to go on, for I am doing right. If only others would be persistent, things would soon be straight. I have not yet heard a word from England, partly, I suppose, because I have not written for my letters to New York. Do not blame me for this neglect. If you knew all that I have been through, you would wonder I had done so much as I have. I teach the ranch children reading in the morning, for the mother is from home sick. I should say to you, if you are a praying man, pray for me. I am obliged to lie down for reasons best known to my breech, so you need not augur too badly from the writing. Ever your affectionate friend, RLS. RLS and Fanny were married on 19th May by the Reverend William Anderson Scott, a Scots Presbyterian minister, at his home in Post Street, San Francisco. Fanny described herself in the register as widowed. After staying 3 days in the Palace Hotel, they left San Francisco on 22nd of May and travelled by ferry and rail northwards, with an overnight stop at South Vallejo, to the small spa town of Calistoga in the Napa Valley, an area now famous for wine production. To Sidney Colvin, February 1880, 608 Bruce Street, San Francisco, California. When I die of consumption, you can put this on my tomb. Robert Louis Stevenson, born 1850, of a family of engineers, died? Nitor Aquis. Home is the sailor, home from the sea, and the hunter, home from the hill. You who pass this grave, put aside hatred, love kindness, be all services remembered in your heart, and all offences pardoned. And as you go down again among the living, let this be your question. Can I make someone happier this day before I lie down to sleep? Thus the dead man speaks to you from the dust. You will hear no more from him.
And thank you very much to Alec Milne and our guest Robert Lou Stevenson. And now time for our Poet of the Week. He emerges from his cupboard and is allowed to read a poem. Let's welcome Trevor Carter. Hello.
Hello, John.
Well, yes, so now that Graham Torrington is no longer doing Late Night Love, perhaps you can furnish us with some poetic equivalent of some, you know, some sort.
How about, do you want one about looking for love or having love?
Looking for love or having love? Well, I don't have love at the minute, so looking.
Yeah, I think a quest.
Yes.
A quest, yeah. So this is Ode to Speed Dating. Love is a fragile flower that may devour those who tease it, and many profit insights into how is best to please it. Most see mating as a game, a frame of chains and hidden levers, where only fools play by the rules and use what tools they can to seize it. Some jokers offer chances of romances by speed dating, hoaxing stokers of their glances, flying furtively to waiting hopeful clients now reliant on this form of tick-box gaming. Will accept this form of debt and wish to get a chance of baiting. A new connection, a quick inspection, a swift reflection on offers floating by facile smiles, some other times, and all the wiles of scribbled noting, around the tables, the secret cables, the place enables, the egos soaring, as rapid scoring, hearts outpouring, amidst their fantasies and gloating. And then the bell spells time to move, get in the groove, the next heart rending, swift encounter, next disclosure, next assessment, next intending, of the exposures, false disclosures, muddled romp with no sensation. The clock ticks on, there isn't long until the gong signals the ending. Some will deride this rapid ride, the quest for bride or chance connection. Condemn as crude and won't be wooed, avoid as lewd and fear infection. But who's to say what comes today will never stay and lack duration? So if it works, enjoy the perks, ignore the smirks and risk selection in chance romance, in verbal dance and quick advances and of suggestions to meet again with calmer brain when fear is slain by love's digestions. Then to explore the need for more, cut to the core of secret longings when need to sin and will to win will have the sting to pierce protections.
Quicker witted than a rapper from the Bronx, our very own Bard from Windmill Hill. Trevor Carter, thank you very much.
Yeah. Can I have got to mention this?
Oh, yes. You've got something to mention? Okay, something to plug? Right, you're holding a leaflet in your grubby paw. Please tell us more.
Yes, this Thursday, 17th of February, we've got a little event, Stories, Stand-Up, Sonnets and Circus Magic at 19 Christmas Steps. And it's £5 or £2 for concessions. And that's the wonderful Darren Hoskins and myself. 8:30.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Well, here he is, the bespectacled Colossus of Rhodes, complete in black. Thank you very much. Jeff Sparks, what is going on this week?
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 18th of February, Bucky will be performing with support from the Deltics at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30pm and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Saturday, 19th of February, Doreen will be performing at the Fiddlers in Wailway Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £8 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I pay tribute to Gary Moore. He was rightly classed as one of the best Irish rock guitarists of his generation and had a career that not only included solo work, but he was also involved in groups like the 1960s Irish rock band Skid Row and, of course, Thin Lizzy. This is a track by Skid Row and is titled The Man Who Never Was. Skid Row with the track The Man Who Never Was. Moving into Sunday, 20th of February, Freight will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. The gig starts at 4pm and entry is free. Finally, on Wednesday, 23rd of February, the Canadian folk punk group The Dreadnoughts will be performing with support from Surfing Turnips and also Dutty Luck at the Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 12 noon every Sunday. We're also broadcasting Preston on Preston FM, no less, and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening, in case you forget, when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
Thanks to our studio guests, Julian Parry and Matthew Wood. Reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. And we also had Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide and Alec Milne reading one of Robert Louis Stevenson's letters. Studio production this week was by Michael Noyce. And the producer was Tony Gosling, co-produced by Addy O'Lighton. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can also find us on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect and I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Wishing you a very good week from all the team in our Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for listening. So until the same time next week,
goodbye.